From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Gomez, all women strike for change. March 8th, year 2000. Be there.
It's a good idea. This is Dorothy Allison.
I hope it's going to make you want to go and strike for change.
Talk about it to your neighbors, families, and friends so we can all join and make it into a global strike on International Women's Day. Be visible, be heard.
It's International Women's Day, a roundtable with women activists and journalists from around the world. And Bush and Gore win big on Super Tuesday. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Arizona Senator John McCain contemplated the future of his campaign today after suffering a Super Tuesday blowout, while George W. Bush turned his focus to Vice President Al Gore, labeling him an agent of Washington. A senior McCain aide, speaking on condition of anonymity, said he expects McCain to depart the GOP contest, but cautioned that no firm decision has been made. McCain is to assess his future at his Arizona retreat. Bill Bradley says he'll make his future plans known in a few days. The Democrat has retreated to his Montclair, New Jersey home to consider the future of his presidential bid against Al Gore. The vice president took a clean sweep over Bradley on Super Tuesday, winning all 15 Democratic contests. He even won New York, where Bradley played pro basketball with the Knicks, and Missouri, where Bradley was born. Bradley all but conceded the race to Al Gore last night. Democratic Party officials say the Bradley campaign aides have told them he's planning to quit the race tomorrow. George W. Bush beat Senator McCain in California and New York, the two biggest delegate prizes at stake on Tuesday, and he won five other primaries as well: Ohio, Georgia, Maine, Missouri, and Maryland. Bush also won caucuses in Minnesota and Washington State. McCain won in New England, in Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Vermont, as voters in 13 states participated in the year's largest night of Republican presidential contests. In all, 613 delegates were at stake. 1,034 are needed for the nomination. Bush won at least 446 delegates, and McCain at least 126, bringing the totals to date to 616 delegates for Bush and 231 for McCain. Californians overwhelmingly voted to denounce gay marriage and ousted a nine-term Congress member from office on a primary election day that otherwise saw strong support for incumbents across the country. California Senator Dianne Feinstein easily defeated a labor lawyer to win the Democratic nomination for a second full term, while in Ohio, Republican Senator Mike DeWine brushed aside his Republican challengers. Maryland Senator Paul Sarbanes polled 84% of the Democratic primary vote in his bid for a fifth term. The incumbent advantage didn't always hold, however. In a heavily Hispanic district east of Los Angeles, 18-year Congressmember Marty Martinez had bucked Democratic leadership on gun control and abortion and lost to California State Senator Hilda Solis in his primary. Martinez was the only incumbent in Congress to lose his seat on Tuesday. With no Republicans running, Solis is all but certain to be elected in November. California voters decided the fate of 20 ballot initiatives on Super Tuesday, most controversial among them Proposition 22, which prevents the state from recognizing gay marriages if they're legalized elsewhere. The measure passed 61% to 39%. Supporters called it a victory for families, while opponents complained the measure was divisive and could be used to keep gay people from seeking health benefits or adopting children. Software millionaire Ron Unz, who successfully pushed a 1998 initiative ending bilingual education, was back this year pushing campaign finance reform. His proposition would have allowed for partial public financing of campaigns and would have banned corporate donations. Voters also came out strongly in favor of a measure that allows prosecutors rather than juvenile court judges to decide whether young people age 14 to 17 are tried as adults. Voters also extended the circumstances under which the death penalty is warranted. The juvenile crime measure was sponsored by former Republican Governor Pete Wilson and corporations such as Chevron, Unocal, and Transamerica. It also limits judges' authority to refer young people to treatment or probation rather than locked facilities, and requires adult prison sentences in most cases for 16-year-olds convicted of felonies in adult courts. An opposition leader called the measure a devastating blow to juveniles in California and said it will push thousands of nonviolent offenders into the criminal justice system. And in Los Angeles County, District Attorney Gil Garcetti, last reelected after the O.J. Simpson trial, appeared headed for a runoff in his campaign for a third term amid criticism of his handling of the Los Angeles Police Department corruption scandal. This news from Florida, as Governor Jeb Bush defended his decision to end affirmative action for university admissions and state contracts, thousands of people gathered nearby to rally against the policy. Singing "We Shall Overcome" and waving signs reading "Jeb Crow" and "Bushwhack," approximately 10,000 people demonstrated against the governor's One Florida plan. It bans consideration of race and gender in admissions to the state's 10 public universities and in the awarding of state contracts. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In this International Women's Day special, I'm Amy Goodman. Today, women around the world are planning work stoppages to demonstrate their own value. Some of the planned activities include a rural women's strike in Burkina Faso, demanding money for birth certificates and identity cards that women can't afford. Noon work stoppages are planned for Catalonia, Spain, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Domestic workers will strike in Port of Spain, Trinidad, and Tobago. In Ireland, women are holding a mobile parliament outside the House of Representatives. They did this last May, calling for March 8th to become a paid holiday for Irish women. They also made citizens' arrests of members of parliament and charged them with pimping off women's unwaged and low-wage work. Today, we'll start the program with a piece that was put together by Margareta Darcy, who is with the International Wages for Housework campaign in Ireland. She did this for the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The global economy is founded on the work women do, not only in sweatshops and on the land with little or no pay, but also the work of giving birth to, caring for, and nurturing, as well as educating the entire working class in every county.
Women were paid for what we do. I'll tell you one thing that's true as true. We wouldn't be free, but I'm telling you there'd be a lot of wages due.
I'm Kay Murphy, and I want all women to strike for a change, for a new millennium that values all women's work and all women's lives. The sooner the better.
Raising the children.
About domestic work, you know?
I know.
Housework.
Laundry.
Grocery shop.
Women do two-thirds of the world's work. Women earn 5% of the world's income.
Now, what do you think would happen if we women went on strike? There'd be no breakfast in the morning. There'd be no screw at night. There'd be no nurses treating you. Be
how
no
the workforce is changing. And it's changing to minorities and women. So you're going to have to do something to correct the other inequities, which is the inequities in child care.
This is Jewel Gomez. All women strike for change. March 8th, year 2000. Be there.
It's a good idea. This is Dorothy Allison.
I hope it's going to make you want to go on strike for change.
Talk about it to your neighbors, families, and friends, because we can all join and make it into a global strike on International Women's Day. Be visible, be heard. Wednesday, March 8th, 2000.
Consider all of the labor that you do that you don't get paid for. Make an invoice of all of this unwaged labor. Send it to your government on March 8th of the year 2000.
Now, what do you think would happen if we women went on strike? There'd be no breakfast.
Put together by Margareta Darcy of the International Wages for Housework campaign in Ireland for the Women's International News Gathering Service, known as WINGS.
It'd be all right. And there'd be no mothers nursing you. There'd be no wives waiting on you. There'd be no time.
And you're listening to Democracy Now! Here on Pacifica Radio. While $700 billion a year is spent on military budgets worldwide, less than $20 billion is spent on the essentials of life: accessible clean water, health, sanitation, and basic education. In Africa, women and girls grow 80% of the food consumed there. In Latin America and the Caribbean, a quarter of the population and up to 90% of the native people have no access to safe drinking water. And in the United States, here, the most powerful country in the world, the major candidates for president for this year, 2000, are four white males. Today, we are joined by women from around the world who are fighting for women's equality in their communities. They're here in New York for a series of meetings at the United Nations to evaluate the state of women's rights 5 years after tens of thousands of women activists gathered in Beijing, China, for the UN World Conference on Women. It's interesting. One of the women who gathered for this conference, Jocelyn Dow, who we've had on, who's with the Red Thread Collective and chair of WEDO, the Women's Environment and Development Organization, said earlier today that she thinks women around the world should get a chance to vote in the U.S. presidential election because the U.S. president determines so much of what happens in the world today. Well, we're joined by June Zeitlin, who is the executive director of WEDO, Women's Environment and Development Organization. And June, I got a chance to see you yesterday leading a panel of women from around the world looking at the state of the world since Beijing 5 years ago. And one of the things you addressed was the U.S. presidential election, putting it in a global context about the issues of parity and where are the women in elections here as well as other places.
Thanks. Yesterday was a panel of women's organizations who had prepared reports parallel to what the governments were doing on the progress that they'd made since Beijing. And at WEDO, we coordinated a report that many U.S. women's organizations contributed to, monitoring how our government has complied with the commitments in the Beijing Platform for Action. And there are two areas that I highlighted. One was the area of political participation, where women make up the majority of voters in this country, but as was noted, all of the major candidates running for office are male, and women have had a very difficult time in this country getting elected. In fact, the U.S. ranks quite far down in the list of countries in terms of representation of women in its legislatures. In the Congress, women represent approximately 13%, and in the Senate, only 9%. While women have done better in state legislatures, we're still less than a quarter. In 1995, the Beijing Platform for Action called for women comprising at least 30% of elected bodies, and we have a long way to go on that. But I think women in the U.S., while we have to work for changing the structural barriers to elections, particularly campaign finance reform, there's something we can do right away, starting today on International Women's Day, and that is demand that at least 50% of women appointed by presidents, governors, mayors, and other executive officials make women half of their cabinet, half of their top-level appointments. The Clinton-Gore administration has appointed more women to its cabinet than any other administration, and particularly in positions such as Secretary of State and Attorney General, where we have the first women occupying those offices. And that's the kind of commitment of translating words into action that we'd like to see in states and cities all over this country.
What about in other places in the world? In Brazil, they've passed a law that requires a certain number of women to be in the parliament.
A number of countries have passed laws either at the parliamentary level or in their political parties requiring that at least 30% or in some cases higher than that have women represented. And this is setting these kinds of goals and targets has been the single most effective mechanism for increasing the level of women's participation in elected office. It has really been the only way to get a critical mass. In the Scandinavian countries, which began this process a number of years ago. They were really the first. In Sweden, women are more than 40%, and in Norway, over 35%. But in countries like South Africa, which began their transition to democracy much more recently, the political parties required that 30% of the people elected be women, and they now have over 30% of women in the parliament. And countries like Brazil and India have adopted these targets at local elections, and there, too, women are achieving a critical mass.
Well, June Zeitlin, we may not have a presidential candidate amongst us here in the United States, but we do have a chief. We're joined by Chief B.C. Agunle. She is Nigerian and founder of the National Coordinator of Country Women Association of Nigeria, which is a rural women's self-help organization which operates in 25 states of Nigeria and has something like 120,000 members. She's also founder and president of the Network of African Rural Women's Associations. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Chief BC.
Thank you very much.
If you were standing last night, either in Texas or perhaps in New York or maybe Tennessee, where the various candidates were giving their speeches after Super Tuesday, what would you be addressing as the major issues that we confront in the world today?
Thank you very much. The major problem that is confronting everybody in the world today is poverty eradication. Poverty is a serious problem. Talking about women going into power, if they have no money, they cannot be part of the power we are talking about. Before, we always think and talk of poverty in the South. But get out to the New York streets today, you will agree with me that the poverty virus is spreading all over the place. And it has just started. This is the time the American government should come up with people-centered poverty eradication program. I am not talking of welfare program. We must agree that everybody, women in particular, is entitled to owning property and earning a living wage in this country. If the rich people refuse to share the wealth, believe me, the poor are very ready, especially the poor women are ready and generous to share the poverty with everybody in the world. You may never know, I agree, they will share it with us.
Chief BC, what role do you think, for example, in your case, how did you end up becoming chief?
I became a chief. My father was a chief. And he was blessed with so many children, men and women. But before he died, he tried to educate everybody. And he said that whoever is the most senior after his death should be made the chief. That is how I inherited the chieftaincy, because I was the most senior child when my father died.
And what responsibilities does it mean you have?
It's a lot of responsibilities, like being the president of your little community. I have to see to the welfare of the people, plan the program that will make everybody comfortable. And that is why I'm very interested, because that is what I do for my community and they like most, that everybody has equal right to own and share what we have in the community. You may have money. Money cannot speak for you. Money does not love sometimes. If you have money and you don't know how to share it with the people will isolate you and you will be miserable. This is why, as a chief, I know what it means for all of us to own what we have and share it together, and that's what I want the world to be.
Well, it is exhilarating to hear a leader speaking the way you do, and perhaps maybe Al Gore or George W. Bush, perhaps they're listening, I don't know, and they can take a few words from your script. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In this International Women's Day special. And I also want to say that during the breaks, when we bring you music, this music is being brought to you by a group of women, women, black activists, and independents. They named that for the Pacifica station here in New York, WBAI. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, this Women's International Day special. I'm Amy Goodman, and thank you very much to our friends Playing the Drums, a group of women drummers here in the studios of Pacifica Station WBAI. We are joined by a roundtable of women from around the world. We'll be going to Jordan to speak with a journalist who is crusading against the killing of women who are killed for what are known as crimes of honor. We'll also be going to Pakistan as well as to Zimbabwe and right here in the United States. As we talk about the issue of parity, I wanted to turn now to Fariha Zafar, who is from the group Shirkat Gah, which means coming together in Pakistan. Yeah, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
As you look at our elections in the United States, at the top level, we see only men who are running for president right now. How does this compare to Pakistan? Actually, the latest news is a previous prime minister, right, went on trial today, and he is charging the current prime minister with building a sham case against him.
Thank you. Well, Pakistan is a very interesting case because we've had a woman prime minister not only once, but she's had two terms in Pakistan. So although we are a very patriarchal society, we do have the distinction of being the first Muslim country to have a woman prime minister. Currently, she's out of the country, and because there are cases against her, she's unable to return home. On the other hand, I think in the case of the United States, it does seem that you're still a long way from having a woman at the top. And we cannot really compare the two situations because otherwise, at the general level, the status of women is much better in this country. In Pakistan, we are still struggling for some of our basic rights. Currently, as you are aware, the constitution is suspended. We have a military government. But again, there is an interesting paradox because whereas the previous democratic government, the prime minister who is under trial, Nawaz Sharif, was not really bringing women into the mainstream, into the political arena. There were very few women pre-October 1999 in the cabinet. There were very few women in the government. Since the military coup, we find that there are more women in the cabinet. There are women in all the provincial as well as at the federal level in the cabinet. There are women ambassadors. Women are being placed on advisory boards and committees. Women are participating in the task force. So there seems to be a much more favorable climate for women. Of course, we are assessing the situation carefully, but we have to work within the given situation. And women have to, in fact, find space for themselves no matter who is there at the top.
You've been involved in assessing your country 5 years after the Beijing Women's Conference, Fariha Zafar. Yesterday, you made a presentation at the United Nations of a shadow report for the women of Pakistan, and that's what women from around the world were doing, looking at how far their countries are away from full equality. Mm-hmm. And what do you think are the areas where in Pakistan women have made the most gains, but also where they're farthest away?
Well, I think the most gains have really been in the high level of awareness of women's issues, which today you find in Pakistan. There has been very little mainstreaming of gender issues. There is talk about it. Even we find that the men are now using very gender-sensitive language. But it's still very much at the level of policies. There is very little implementation of programs. We have a national plan of action, which emerged out of the Beijing platform of action. But the action plan has yet to be operationalized, although the process does seem to have started again very recently. We also find that women have made gains in the sense that particularly the women working in the NGOs are now being called upon by government to act as experts on committees. There are three women in the national delegation right now to this preparatory committee meeting at the UN from Pakistan. all are, in fact, from the NGO sector, but they are here as experts and not really representing their NGOs.
And for people who aren't familiar with that term, NGO, in this international community in New York, we forget, it's sort of called nonprofits, but the non-governmental organizations.
Right. But I think the major problem for women in Pakistan, there are three which we identified in our shadow report. One is globalization, increasing globalization. And I think we have to be very careful that the impact of globalization at the international level on women has been to raise the poverty levels. Poverty has arisen in Pakistan from 30% in the 80s to over 40% during the 90s. And as we are all aware, and my sister from Africa has already stated, that the majority of the women are poor. I mean, the majority in the below the poverty line are women. So when we look at the elections here in the United States, what we would like to see is a differential study of the differential impact of globalization in other countries of the world. And certainly the impact of globalization in the third world and the developing countries is very negative, and there are very few positive gains for women. We also find that because of increasing poverty as a result of globalization, there is increasing violence, and that is our second priority area. Because violence is generated from poverty, it is generated also from the socio-cultural environment. You have heard of honor killings in Pakistan, and since it was referred to in the African context, we are hoping that even today the government may have made some kind of a positive statement regarding honor killings, and we are trying to move for some kind of legislation against honor killings.
And what do you mean by honor killings?
Well, honor killings are women who are killed in the name of honor, of disobeying, let us say, the cultural values, if they are perceived to have defied the socio-cultural norms, which would include going out and marrying somebody of their own choice against the family's wishes, of being suspected perhaps of some kind of relationship, illicit relationship or with men, of maybe even moving out into the public sphere without the permission of the family and the patriarchal head of the family. So it has a very broad definition. This connotation of honor killings is very broad. But we're hoping that at least there should be no judgment should be pronounced which legalizes or which states that yes, an honor killing is justified in any part of the country. And we are hoping for a very positive statement from the government today. It might already have come, but I haven't been able to get any feedback from Pakistan in the morning so far. The other area which affects women in Pakistan is the lack of political participation. As I said, although we've had a woman prime minister and she's had two terms, but there are very few women who are leaders in political parties. There are very few women in parliament. Right now, of course, parliament is suspended. But we do find also that women at the administrative level, especially at the higher levels, we have less than 5% women represented at higher administrative posts. And the relationship between globalization, lack of political participation, and violence, this negative sort of combination of the three factors we find is really continuing to keep the status of women at a low level in the country. But despite that, despite the setbacks, despite the obstacles in the last 5 years since the Beijing conference, we find that there is a greater awareness, there is more empowerment of women. Women are much more vocal about and aware about their issues. And there is greater collaboration amongst organizations on women's issues.
I want to continue this issue of honor killings. Fariha Zafar of Shirkatgah coming together in Pakistan, and also take this issue to Jordan. 3 weeks ago, thousands of Jordanians urged their country's lawmakers to stiffen the lenient penalties handed down to murderers who claim the family's honor was at stake. The demonstrations mark the loudest outcry yet against what's known as honor crimes. At least 20 Jordanian women are killed each year for simply talking to a man, dating, or having sex outside of marriage. Being raped is also seen as disgracing the family, as is refusing an arranged marriage or leaving an abusive husband. Jordanian law gives to those who commit their female relatives under these circumstances with sentences usually ranging from 3 months to 1 year. And tonight on HBO, there's going to be a documentary that plays called Crimes of Honor. And we go to Amman right now to speak with Rana Husseini, who is one of the people featured in this documentary. But first, a clip from Crimes of Honor.
Day breaks in Jordan with a call to the faithful. But one girl feels forsaken, far from home.
I'm lost in a desert. I don't know where it begins or where it ends. I don't know what to do or to whom I can turn. I've done a very stupid thing. I ran away from home. I know my family believes I brought them shame. Please help me to reach them and read them this letter. Please, save me.
Her name was Rania. She ran away for love. The price was her life.
An excerpt of the documentary that is being aired on HBO tonight called Crimes of Honor. And we're joined by Rana Husseini, who is a writer for the Jordan Times, Jordan's English language newspaper. She has led a crusade against honor crimes and has received the support of Jordan's royal family. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Rana Husseini.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very good. Can you tell us right now what the state of awareness is in Jordan around the issue?
I think, as you said, you mentioned earlier that there was a strong march, the strongest so far. I think that many things have been taking place in Jordan, and of course the latest was the march, which also pushed many newspapers and columnists and editors to start writing more about this issue and showing the injustices that's being inflicted on women. Also, this issue has been talked about in the past, and as you said, there's support from the royal family, which is very important. Of course, you will face opposition at one point in time. But all in all, the situation is improving, and there's more awareness about this issue.
I understand. Is it true that there were more men than women at the rally, and that Prince Ali, the brother of Jordan's King Abdullah II, and Prince Ghazi, the king's cousin, were there?
Yeah. The show-up was more tribal men showing their dismay of what's going on, and also it was led by Prince Ali and Prince Ghazi.
Uh-huh. Yet, twice before, Jordan's all-male lower house of parliament has turned down attempts to amend the law.
Yeah, I think the parliament, the deputies did not understand clearly the government's motives behind this change, and many were distracted from the real truth. But we are hoping now, with the march and with all the publicity that's going on, that the deputies will get a clearer look and understanding of the real motive behind our march, which is to call for the cancellation of one of two articles that gives leniency to criminals in Jordan for crimes of honor, and to explain to them that this is a discrimination against women, and it violates our Islamic Sharia, which in no way applauds these killings. Islam is very clear. You have to have four witnesses to a case of an adultery. And even if it's proven, it's not the individual who takes the life of a female individual, but rather a ruler. So this is what we're trying to show them. Also, what irritated the deputies was their belief that this move is coming from the West. and that it's a Western plot aimed at destroying our Jordanian morals and women and society. So now we are trying to lobby to inform them and to explain to them our point of view, and we hope that in the next joint session, which is going to be in May, that things will turn around.
I think it's interesting, a connection to the United States. One of the cases that became known here was a young Jordanian woman who fell in love with a Palestinian engineer. The young man proposed to her, but the woman's father forbade the marriage because the man was Palestinian and didn't make enough money. The father then gathered 14 members of the family and said that they were going to have her killed. She tried to apply for asylum in the United States, but ultimately the United States denied that asylum.
Yeah, I heard the story.
Well, I want to ask our guest, Fariha Zafar, if in Pakistan there is this level of consciousness that there is in Jordan right now with thousands of people marching.
Well, the level of consciousness is there because over the last few years there have been a number of cases where women have married of their own choice or left the home simply to be more in control of their own lives, all of which fall within the very broad definition of dishonoring the family. In fact, there has been a concerted movement in Pakistan at different levels against honor killings. This has been taken up by various human rights organizations. It has been taken up by other women's organizations, particularly the broad platform of the Women's Action Forum, which brings all women's organizations together at the level of activism in the sense of bringing out demonstrations out on the street. It has also been taken up by the organization that I'm representing here, which is Shirkat Gao, which is looking, in fact, at a comparative analysis of the Islamic Sharia and what are the cultural practices in the different parts, and, in fact, identifying that there is nothing in the Sharia in support of honor killings. And, in fact, whenever we talk to the men and to the patriarchal heads of families and tribes and the feudal elements in society, the whole notion of honor killings is stated to be against our cultural traditions and norms. So the attempt in Pakistan is both at the level of research, at the level of creating awareness, as well as activism out on the streets. But a great deal of work is being done in terms of lobbying with the government, with the judiciary, with the legislators, and now, of course, with the military government and their civilian counterparts, because we feel that this needs a multifaceted approach has to be developed in order for honor killings to be outlawed.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Fariha Zafar, for joining us from Pakistan, the group Shirkat Gao, and also to our guest on the phone from Aman Rana Husseini, award-winning journalist from the Jordan Times, leading a crusade against honor crimes. And that movie tonight, called Honor Crimes, Crimes of Honor, will be aired on Cinemax, a part of HBO, at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. When we come back, we're going to talk about women's reproductive rights, particularly focusing on Africa, and talk about the role of the media as a powerful force in elevating women around the world. We'll be joined by a former journalist from Zimbabwe. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we take our break with Women Drummers. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, our International Women's Day special. Women around the world marching for equality and striking on this day. This news from Kuwait. Kuwaiti women activists marked International Women's Day today by filing a court case against the Interior Minister and Parliament Speaker, demanding full political rights. For some 40 years, Kuwaiti women, seen as the most liberal in the Muslim Gulf Arab region, have campaigned for equal rights with men, allowing them to vote and stand in elections. Kuwait's the only Gulf Arab state with an elected parliament, but women, half of all Kuwaitis, are not allowed to take part. Parliament in November narrowly rejected a draft law granting women full political rights. We're joined now by Maurice Fontef. She is the Africa staff attorney for the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy, and she and a group of women from around the world are going to be holding a panel today at the United Nations on the issue of reproductive rights around the world. Can you tell us what you see are the most critical issues right now that you're working on?
Yes. First of all, let me start by explaining a little bit what are reproductive rights, because it seems to me that there may be a misconception about what exactly the term means. Reproductive rights are the rights of people, but more particularly women, because they are the ones who bear children, to decide the number, spacing, and timing of their children. This means what? This means specifically, concretely, access to contraception. It means specifically being able to protect yourself from sexually transmitted infections, including HIV/AIDS. It means also that if the contraception you are using has failed, or if you have been raped, or if you have been a victim of incest, or if you have a specific health condition, that you be able to have access to legal abortions. It also means that you be able to bring children into the world safely. So we're talking about maternal mortality, safe motherhood. But it's broader than that. It really means that in order to be able to make these decisions about how many children to have and when to have children, we also look at the role of women in marriage. We look at the access of women to education, access of women to credit, everything that can empower a woman to make these decisions.
So talk specifically about what you'll be raising today, looking at, well, this is a huge question because we're talking about the whole continent of Africa, which is a bit ridiculous, but...
Well, actually, I focus on sub-Saharan Africa, and I focus on 14 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, 7 Francophone countries and 7 Anglophone countries. And we have recently published 2 major reports on the laws and policies. Specifically, we look at, we are an organization, Center for Reproductive Law and Policy, dedicated to promoting the reproductive rights of women, but we look specifically at laws and policies that affect the reproductive rights of women. And so what the panel will be about today, from 1 to 3 at the UN, is the gains and the losses since Beijing.
Well, talk specifically about some of the countries you've been looking at.
Specifically, in the countries that we have looked at with regards to reproductive rights, I must say that the trend is fairly positive and very encouraging in the sub-Saharan African countries that we have looked at.
Which countries?
As I said, we looked at 14 countries, 7 Francophones, 7 Anglophones. So we looked at Zimbabwe, South Africa, Nigeria, Ethiopia, Tanzania, Kenya and Ghana on the Anglophone side. And for the Francophone side, we looked at Benin, Côte d'Ivoire, Mali, Senegal, Chad, Cameroon.
Can you give us an example of a particular state, a particular country, and where they have progressed, where you feel the laws are helping women?
Right. Well, we've looked at, for example, laws against rape. And in the past few years, the laws against rape in a couple of countries, for example, in Senegal and Côte d'Ivoire, have the definition of rape has changed to become more inclusive of acts other than specific sexual penetration of a woman. So the definition is more gender neutral and also includes acts other than penetration of a penis into a vagina. So, for example, anal penetration would also be considered as rape. We've also looked at the abortion laws, and the one that stands out is the abortion law in South Africa, which is very liberal and allows abortion for a woman, no questions asked, up to the 12th week. There have been also laws that have been adopted in a couple of countries that have to do with domestic violence, South Africa being one of them. Mauritius is another one of them. And we regard that as also a very positive development. In a couple of countries, Senegal and Côte d'Ivoire, they have adopted laws also against sexual harassment in the workplace. And finally, when we look at what we consider harmful traditional practices, one of them being female genital circumcision or female genital mutilation, a number of countries have adopted laws against this practice.
And we're talking to Maurice Fontouf, who is Africa staff attorney for the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy. One of the ways that change happens, especially when you don't have a lot of women in the parliaments or governments of countries, is through just pressure from the grassroots and also from the media. We have with us Doreen Mukwena, who is national director of the African Media Women in Zimbabwe. Doreen, can you talk about the power of the media and what role you see that it plays?
Thank you, Emmy. The media is very critical, as noticed already in the Beijing Platform of Action, that it is one of the factors that hinder women's advancement, in that the media is strong in putting issues on the agenda. And if women are excluded, if women's voices, opinions are excluded in the media, it really means that their opinions are also excluded in the national debates or in the global debates that take place in affecting their decisions. And the media is also critical in influencing perspectives and opinions as a lobbying mechanism with international institutions, with governments, with national associations. So being critical in that manner, the involvement of women should also be very high within the media.
So how does the Zimbabwean press respond to your pressure? What exactly do you do?
The focus of our organization is to monitor the portrayal of women in the media and also to seek ways of correcting the portrayal of women in the media. We are also making interventions in projecting women's voices, creating opportunities like you have done this morning, creating an opportunity that women's voices, women's opinions be projected in the national media so that their voices, their opinions are taken into consideration when decisions that affect them are made.
Are there many Zimbabwean women reporters?
Yes, there are many Zimbabwean women reporters, both in the electronic and in the print media, and who are focusing on women's issues. Sometimes it's a disadvantage for women to be looking specifically at women's issues and seeking gender balance within the media because it disadvantages them. The media environment has always been a male domain, and it's structured to look down, as it were, on focusing on women's issues. So those are some of the contentions that they are meeting. But all the same, the media has, in Zimbabwe, has kind of been very responsive. Though we are not talking about the media jungle that we have here in the United States of America, but we are talking about a few media houses that we can specifically target and focus on, countable, like we only have one broadcasting institution in Zimbabwe, which is state-owned, and hence it's easy for us to be targeting just one institution and engaging them in dialogue on the specific issues of interest to us.
By the way, UNESCO Director General Matsura has called on the world media to ensure that women journalists have editorial control of the news on International Women's Day, and I hope it extends beyond just International Women's Day. And we have this news in an address smuggled out of Burma to mark International Women's Day today. Pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi says her country women bear the brunt of economic and political hardship in the military state. Suu Kyi said in a videotaped statement made available to news organizations in Bangkok, Thailand, "Our political problems are such that there are now many political prisoners in Burma. When men are taken prisoners, it is the women folk who are left to struggle." Aung San Suu Kyi won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1991 for her peaceful struggle for democracy in Burma, which she still wages. I think it's very interesting that in Beijing, that the media was taken on as a major issue, and that when the shadow reports are being done, that the media is one of the areas that are looked at as well. Here, I think in the United States, the media tries to remove itself and say, you have no right to influence us, when, of course, the people who run the media are reflections of society. I wanted to ask you, June Zeitlin, executive director of the Women's Environment and Development Organization, who presented the shadow report in the United States. We are used to hearing reports on developing countries around the world, but not about human rights in the United States. What you see the role of the media is here, and how women's groups can use the media in facilitating, you know, progress?
I think it's a very important question here, because the media helps to shape so much public opinion. And while women are better represented in the media today than they were previously, there's still few instances of women being in leadership and decision-making positions. And what's even more important, or equally important, is bringing a gender perspective, a different lens, to bring women's experiences into the newsroom, into broadcasting, and into looking at issues. And I, too, would hope that women would bring this not just on one day, but every day of the year, because women often experience issues such as poverty or violence differently than men. And if only men are reporting on it, the public views this through a male lens. And I think particularly when we're talking about poverty, women do bear the brunt of this, not just in other countries of the world, but in the United States, too, as they struggle to work and provide for their children. And often when we talk about poverty, it's, as we say in the law biz, a reasonable man. And I think we have to view it from the lens of women and their families.
You raised yesterday in a presentation at the United Nations the issue of the U.S. not being signatories to some of the key treaties internationally. I don't think the U.S. government likes to be put into an international context or held accountable.
Yeah, this is a really key demand of women in the United States. We view the United Nations as a very important fora for advancing women's equality all over the world. And the U.S. has been shameful in its failure to pay its dues. And even when a compromise was reached to finally pay their dues, it was a compromise reached on the backs of women and hindering the exercise of reproductive rights and reproductive health worldwide. In terms of human rights treaties, again, the U.S. is out of step with the rest of the world, despite our claim to leadership in this arena. The U.S. is one of two countries in the world, Somalia being the other, that has not ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and one of only a handful of nations that has not ratified the Convention for the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. And I think there's no greater act that the U.S. government could take in respect and honoring women on International Women's Day than for the Senate to ratify this convention. Unfortunately, I don't think it's likely to happen.
We're talking on this International Women's Day with women from around the globe about the critical issues that women face today. We were speaking with a representative who's at the United Nations right now in this PrepCon that is taking place on women's issues, looking at Beijing plus five, Fariha Zafar, about the issue of globalization. And I was wondering, in Pakistan, how people perceive the battle in Seattle, and if they saw that as a battle against globalization that served people in Pakistan.
Well, I think there were mixed feelings regarding it. Initially, I think there was a lot of excitement that finally, you know, the women, the people have come out in Seattle. But then I think some of the issues that were being addressed were perhaps those which were not that relevant for our part of the world. And I think the other thing that I would like to say is regarding globalization, that if the gap, the income gaps are growing, both in the United States, in the developed countries, as well as in the developing countries, and without some kind of a reduction in the income gaps, in the poverty levels, women's equality or gender equality, which we are all looking for, is not going to be easy to attain. So we have to look at the whole notion of gender equality in an unequal world and move for greater equality at all levels, economic, political, as well as gender equality.
If people in the United States want to get involved in the assessment of the state of this country when it comes to women, where can they get information? I was going to recommend one place just on the web, going to the PeaceNet's homepage, www.igc.org. One of the things they're doing today is showing you the protests, global protests, the women's strike, the global women's strike all over the world and what's taking place. Where would each of you recommend?
Well, I would certainly encourage you to contact WEDO, the Women's Environment and Development Organization. You can reach us by phone at 212-973-0325 or on email. It's WEDO@igc.org, and our website is www.wedo.org.
And Maurice Fontouf of the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy.
Well, you can contact the center's website, the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy has a website which gives information about laws and policies.
I guess you can just put
the
name of the organization in and then you'll find the website. Okay. And does your organization in Pakistan have any kind of website?
I'm afraid I don't have the website address, but I can give the email contact, which would be for Shirkat Gah, Shirkatgah, at cyber.net.pk.
.pk.
Yes.
And we'll have all of this on our website at pacifica.org and democracynow.org. Finally, Doreen Mukwena of Africa Media Women in Zimbabwe.
We do not have a website yet, but our email address is famwz at samara, S-A-M-A-R-A, .co.co.zw.
Well, we'll put that on our website as well. And I want to thank you all for being with us for the celebration of International Women's Day. And I also want to thank women, black activists, and independent, the women drummers who are in the studio with us, as well as Frieda Wharton of WINGS, the Women's International News Gathering Service. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Metlin's our technical director. Today, our engineer is Matthew Finch. Our email address is democracy@pacifica.org. And again, that film, Crimes of Honor, tonight on Cinemax HBO, both Pacific Time and Eastern Standard Time at 7 p.m. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!